A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The late night lip service for lovers, loners, and lounge lizards.
Yeah, well, where exactly is your accent from?
The late night alternative with Ian Lee.
Oh, I've forgotten your name already, excuse me.
On Talk Radio.
This is the movie version of the song Radiohead from the movie True Stories, okay, which is one of my favourite films. I saw it about 20 years ago and was like, wow, this is like Head for the 80s. Hallelujah, it's finally been released on a Criterion Collection DVD. It came out earlier this year, like last month, and I got it, and it's packed full of extras. The original movie soundtrack is released for the first time. Talking Heads released a True Stories album where it's them doing the songs from the movie, and it's great. But this is the original. This is John Goodman and the whole cast doing the songs.
And what I liked about that film was I had never seen it before, but you used it as a test of our friendship.
Yes.
Now, is she going to like this? Because if she doesn't, 5 years out the window.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Yeah.
What a film.
And I know a few of you have seen it as a direct result. Anyway, the DVD is packed full of extras, as it should be. No director's commentary, disappointing, but the rest of it is packed full of extras. And I fell down a couple of rabbit holes in the extras. The first one was a gentleman called Spalding Gray, who plays the mayor in the movie. And I remember seeing it years ago and thinking, this guy is an incredible performer. He's doing these weird things with his hands. And I've kind of fallen down a Spalding Gray rabbit hole. Amazing performance artist and actor. Did a series of one-man shows. Did a movie with Nick Brumfield, who we love. Really tragic life. Committed suicide, I think it's about 10, 15 years ago. So I've kind of been stocking up on books on DVDs. And then I saw this Tobolowsky character kind of popped up as one of the people involved who supposedly, you see the movie, and it's Stephen Tobolowsky, written by, and he's on there as part of the extras going, yeah, didn't write the movie. And I kind of was Googling him, and he's been in over 200 movies, and I recognised him, of course, from Groundhog Day. And the weekend I discovered his wonderful podcast, and I was listening to four of those. You listened to about three or four of them as well.
I did. I was tidying my wardrobe. I folded everything. It's a good job my kids didn't come in. They would have been folded up and put away too.
It's such a good podcast. It's so good. And I just, on an off chance, sent Stephen an email. And Stephen foolishly replied and agreed to come on the show this evening. And we have Stephen on the line now. Good evening, Stephen.
Good evening, Ian.
It's so nice to talk to you, man, honestly. And your voice is so familiar because I've seen you in... I've not seen all 200 movies, let's be honest, but I've seen you in so many movies. I've seen you in the Goldbergs, the series that's kind of just showing over here. And I've got to say, man, your podcast, the Tobolowsky Letter...
Files.
I keep calling it letters. Files. What a joy, man. Was that fun to do?
Well, it's still being fun. It was kind of an accident the way the whole thing happened. This is another story, I guess. In 2008, I was riding a horse on the side of an active volcano in Iceland.
And we're off.
And we're off. This is absolutely true. This is no exaggeration, is that I got hit by a gigantic wind off the Atlantic Ocean that lifted me and my horse off the ground carried us several feet, dropped me on the other side of the road, and my horse kind of thought it was like God saying, giddy up. And that horse took off, and I got thrown onto a hardened lava flow somewhere on the other side of the mountain.
Ouch.
And I was, I know, I was going in and out of consciousness, and I ended up breaking my neck in five places, and the middle vertebra was C4, what the pros call it,
yes.
C4, got crushed. So when I got back to the United States, my doctor told me I had a fatal injury, which was pretty shocking. It was at first I thought it was kind of a terrible misuse of the word fatal, because obviously it wasn't, and I was scared. And then I thought, wait a minute, this is kind of inspirational.
Oh, come on.
What if what the doctor said was true and I really died on the mountain in Iceland? What are some of the stories I have never told my boys about their dad? And so I started writing these stories about first love and first adversaries and Radiohead, et cetera, like stories which became the Tobolowsky Files, yeah. as kind of a way so my kids would know who their dad was. And coincidentally, it'll come as no surprise to any parent listening to this, my children have not listened to any of it. None of it. But it became a podcast that I guess has gone all over the world now, and of these nutty, crazy, but true stories. That's the Tobolowsky Files.
They are beautifully told, the beautifully written. I do want to talk about true stories, because I've devoured, yeah. all of the extras on there, and I found episode 44 of your podcast, which is the one where you talk about working with David Byrne, and you and your wife wrote the movie, gave him the movie, and then didn't hear anything for a year. Is that right?
Well, Beth wasn't my wife. She was my girlfriend of 16 years.
Okay.
And she had just won the Pulitzer Prize for dramatic literature,
wow.
in America for her play Crimes of the Heart. And so Jonathan Demme, who did Stop Making Sense, yeah. with David, really wanted to get Beth to write David's movie, True Stories. So Beth met with David, and she called me up and said, I have no idea what David is talking about. Maybe you should come over and you talk to David. So I went over and talked to David, and I didn't understand quite what David was talking about. But on the wall of his home, which had no furniture in it, on the wall of his home, there were about 200 pencil drawings. And he said, could you turn these drawings into a movie? And I looked at them for about 2 hours, and I said, David, I'll tell you what, I'll go home, I'll write something, an outline or some sort of, and if you like it, you can hire me to do the movie. If you don't like it, you could keep whatever I write and use it anyway, whatever. So anyway, that night I wrote 35 pages of outline and scenes and character descriptions from True Stories, wow. that became True Stories. David hired me. And then he called up Beth and said, well, if I have Stephen working on the structure and the characters, Beth, can you be working on the movie too? So Beth and I wrote the first draft of True Stories in 19 days, which is not a lot of time.
No, that sounds quite speedy for a movie treatment or script, yeah.
Right. And we gave it to David. And then, as you have mentioned, we did not hear from David for a year. And then I'm driving through the Hollywood Hills and I hear a knock, knock, knock on my car window. And it's David Byrne on a bicycle beside my car. And he's gesturing for me to roll down the window. So I roll down the window. He goes, Stephen, sorry, haven't been back in touch with you. You know, we've been on the road with the Talking Heads, and I got your script, and I changed a lot of it. I changed most everything. But are you going to be home this afternoon? Because there's something I really want you to hear. And I said, sure. So I went home, and David went and got his guitar and came over.
Wow.
And he said, I really liked the story you told me about how when you were young, you had this experience where you heard tones in your head. So I wanted one of the characters in the movie to have that. And he sat there and said, and I wrote this song for them. So he played me in my living room the song Radiohead. And I went, damn. Not only was it a fantastic song, but this event, this kind of psychic event, happened to me when I was 19 years old.
And this really happened, didn't it, Stephen? You recount this in the podcast. You just found yourself saying stuff and answering questions that were absolutely spot on and with stuff that you couldn't have known.
It was horrible. It was
really?
It was one of the worst periods of my... It began... We were on a movement retreat, so I'm 19 years old, and my movement teacher takes us out on a retreat, which sounded really stupid. It sounded like we were going to be doing the same thing we did in class, but closer to bugs and farther away from good toilets.
Sounds awful.
And so at the end, we're sitting around the fire, and he says, I want everyone to say the first thing that comes into your mind. And my teacher is at 12 o'clock, if you imagine that clock,
yeah.
And I'm at 6 o'clock, and people around the circle, the book Lord of the Rings was out at the time, so they were going like, Frodo, and then the next person said, like, Gandalf,
oh, God.
And the next person said, Frodo, and then the next person said, well, he just took my word, and my teacher said, don't filter, just say what you want to say. Okay, Frodo. And so it's coming around to me, and I'm hating this exercise.
Mm.
I have no idea what I'm going to say. And then I hear this sound in my head, like this tone in my head. And the teacher said, Stephen, what would you like to say? And I looked at my teacher, and I said, I think your name is not your name. I think you're operating under an assumed identity, and your real initials are either JK or JL. Pause. Then the teacher goes to the next one. All right, you're up next, Don. He goes, Gandalf. And it goes back around the circle. So we're all breaking, and I'm going to my car, and out of the shadows, my teacher comes and says, Stephen, why did you say what you said about me? And I said, I'm sorry. You just said, don't filter, say what you want. He said, because it's true.
Oh, my God.
I have an assumed name. I came here, I changed my name, and my initials are JK, like you said. So I ask you, how did you know that? And I said, I have no idea. He said, has anyone ever done psychic experiments with you? And I go, no. I mean, this is Texas in what, like, I'm 19, so it's like the 70s. There's no psychic experiments. So I go over to his house one day, and it was one of the – he asked me to come – over to do these psychic experiments. I asked if I could bring Beth, who was a freshman at the time, and I was dead in love with her.
Yeah.
And this was kind of our first date. I took her over to our teacher's house. We're holding hands over this Japanese prayer stool. And he says, okay, Stephen, now just tell me what you see. Well, I didn't see anything. I heard things.
Yeah.
So I hear this sound. And I say, I think there's a 5-year-old over by your fireplace, and there's a 40-year-old woman on the telephone. And my teacher lets go of my hands, like starts walking around the room in a panic. And I said, what's wrong? What's wrong? And he says, I was babysitting my 5-year-old nephew. He was over by the fireplace. I told him it wasn't safe. He ran out the front door and was hit by a car.
Oh, no.
My sister, on her 40th birthday, called on the telephone. You pointed to and committed suicide.
Oh, God.
At this point, I'm starting to cry. And Beth and I drive her back to the dorm, and she says, what do you know about me? And I said, nothing. And she says, well, maybe we should hold hands and you should concentrate.
Fantastic.
And I'm thinking, like, hey, you know, there could be something.
This is working.
Stuff. Now it's going. So I hold Beth's hands, and I said, Beth, I don't see anything. And she looked at me, says, no. You don't see things. You hear things. Do I make a sound? And I said, yes, Beth, you do. And I said, and she said, what do I make? And for some reason, this came out of my mouth. This was pretty much word for word. I said, you have three tones in the male range. Male tones are higher than female tones. Your three tones are in harmony. Wow. She said, what does that mean? I said, well, it either means you are sufficient unto yourself or you always get your way. And Beth looked at me and said, we're going to make a fortune. Let's be partners. Look, I'll go gather people from the theater department together. I'll bring them to you. You hold their hands. You listen to you. Whatever you want to say. We'll charge a quarter each, maybe even a dollar. And then you say this, whatever. This is great. And we'll put the money in a jar and we'll save it. And I'm thinking like, man, this sounds like a relationship to me. And so Beth started bringing people from the theater department over, but it was grim. I would hold people's hands, and I would say things that were awful that there was no way I could know. I would say to someone, you've just had a very close death in your family. You're going to get an inheritance right now. There are discussions as to how you're going to invest the money. He was absolutely freaked out.
Wow.
I'm holding one girl in my theater department's hand. I go, you're trying to get over the fact that you were sexually abused by your father. It haunts you. Oh. You know, and she breaks down into tears, runs. It was not fun. It was, and the more I listened and the more I heard these tones, the more tones came into my head. And this, when David Byrne first came over to our house, he wanted to know if we had a swimming pool. And because Beth had just won the Pulitzer Prize, oh, yeah.
You had a few quid going. You were living the fancy life.
The fancy life. We had a swimming pool. And if you go onto YouTube and see his video of Road to Nowhere, all the water, swimming pool, underwater scenes were shot at our home.
Well played.
So while David is shooting Road to Nowhere, we're talking about what he's working on next, and he mentions he wants to do this true stories thing about people that have these incredible events that have happened in their life that are impossible to be true but are true. And that's when Beth said, well, you should talk to my sweetie because he hears tones. And David looked at me and kind of laughed and goes, you hear tones? And I go, well, you know, so it was a long time ago. And that was the genesis of the story that David ended up putting in the movie and wrote the song about. So in a way, David Byrne, bless his heart, chronicled the beginning of my relationship with Beth.
Isn't that beautiful?
And it's wonderful. That part of the story is wonderful. And of course, David's a genius, so I'm very happy he wrote the song.
Well, of course, for those who don't know, the band Radiohead got their name from that. So your early romance with Beth continues on throughout their work. When was I've got so many questions. When did the tones stop? Have they stopped?
No. But I quit actively seeking to hear tones, but I still hear them. I could still hear them. Now, I have no idea how I translate the tones into saying something meaningful.
Right. Yeah.
But like, here is a horrible, horrible story. It was, you know, it seems like, Ian, you just bring the terrible stories.
I'm so sorry. We're going to go to the light in a minute. I promise, Stephen, we will go to the light.
It was, my birthday was coming up, and my wife, Ann, said, I'm going to, now Annie and I, we've been married 30 years. She says, I have a little birthday thing planned for you. And I said, okay. And I hear this thing in my head. I said, I tell you, you know, you're always joking about my the ESP and all this stuff. I said, I'll tell you what, it's all just foolishness. I'm going to write on a piece of paper what the birthday is, and then we'll go and have our birthday party, and you'll come back and see what I heard in my head, and you'll know that it's all just a crock. So I got a piece of paper, and I wrote, we're going to drive down to downtown Los Angeles to the concert hall, and Anne got me permission to play on the grand piano of the stage of Disney Hall. And so anyway, I write that, seal it in an envelope, and Anne says, well, we're going to lunch at a really nice place, so maybe you should dress up in a suit or something like that.
God.
I'm saying, oh, okay. And she says, the restaurant is kind of downtown, so why don't we just kind of head toward you know where we go to concerts, you know, Disney Hall? You know, if you park in the basement of the concert, the restaurant's right across the street. And I am about to puke. Do you have that word in England?
Yeah,
we have the word puke, yes.
I'm just like going absolutely pale. We go up the elevator, and there's the custodian of the concert hall, and he goes, right this way, sir. And they open the doors.
Oh,
there's the grand piano on the center of the stage at Disney Hall. A friend of mine has come from home with all of my music, comes up on stage, and I get to play on the stage of Disney Hall for about an hour and a half. And
incredible.
I'm thinking the whole time, I'm going to get murdered when we get home. It's going to be so bad. Anne came home and she was laughing, and then she opened up the envelope and went absolutely pale. And she was certain that either I had overheard her phone conversations or had been spying on her computer or something. And I said, no, baby, no, it just for some reason, that's what I heard and that's what we had. But those kind of things happen a lot.
It's incredible. And here's the thing, you know, I me and Kath, we don't normally tend to believe this stuff. But when we heard it in your podcast, I'm telling it now, how can you doubt this? How can you doubt this experience? Let's move away from the dark a little bit. When was the last time you saw David Byrne? Have you seen him at all recently? Did you see him when the Criterion were putting the DVD together?
No, I didn't. I saw David about 3 years ago. I want to say maybe 2-3 years ago with Jeff Bezos. We were at a kind of conclave in Santa Fe, out kind of around Santa Fe, New Mexico, and everybody was Jeff Bezos brought together about 50 different people to present different entertainments for one another. That were kind of mind-blowing, and David was one of the presenters, and I was doing one of my stories for everybody. So I saw David again after that time, and it was odd. It was odd seeing David after so many years, but it was fun. It was fun seeing him, and we ended up having a wonderful talk.
This actually may be the last dark question. Then we're going to take a break, if you don't mind, and then we will come back to the light. In the True Stories episode of your podcast, you talk. Listen, I'm a former cocaine addict, right? I'm a junkie. I'm in recovery and all of this, and I've never heard anyone describe the what cocaine does in such a beautiful and devastating description. You describe it something like it's energy that you've borrowed from your future that you have to pay back with interest, and it's a very selfish act. And I just wondered what your relationship with cocaine was. Was it an irregular thing? What did you ever get a problem with cocaine, or was it just like every now and then? If you don't mind me asking.
No, I don't mind you asking, but Ian, it just bit me on the ass. Mm. And it wasn't as bad as some of our friends. You have to remember, this was kind of the 1980s. And back then, it wasn't that cocaine was addictive. It was that it was expensive.
Right.
That was the rap on cocaine. Nobody ever thought, oh, you're going to get addicted to this stuff. It was like something that made you, you know, flirt with other men's wives.
Yeah.
That's all it was. And so I would use it for a party. I was in a rock band at the time, and we would do it afterwards to party. And it got to be where I felt I really needed it more than I wanted to need it.
Right.
And like I said, other friends of mine went, like you were talking before, down the rabbit hole. Other friends of mine, it really destroyed their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with a method of getting myself off of cocaine, in which I had someone actually from London read my method, and they used it, and it helped them undo it. And if briefly what my method was,
yeah.
I said, I wasn't addicted to cocaine. I was addicted to the cash machine that I needed to get the cash to buy the cocaine.
Right.
So maybe if what I did is I spent the exact same amount of money I was spending on cocaine every week, but I had to spend it on me. I couldn't
wow.
save the world. I couldn't do anything. I had to spend it on me. And the first week it was easy.
Yeah.
You know, the first week I like bought a set of encyclopedias. I bought some Cuban cigars. I bought like Paradis brandy. Second week it was not so easy. I'm buying like some Italian suits. It was and I have to keep spending this money every week on me of new stuff. And it became exhausting spending money on myself.
Yeah.
And after 8 weeks, I said, I can't do it anymore. I'm stopping this. And I realized that for the last 8 weeks, I had not done any cocaine. And I had lost the physical need for cocaine.
Brilliant.
And I had transformed myself into a narcissistic actor with a closet full of Italian suits, the richest brandies in the world, Waterford Crystal. It didn't improve my personality, but I wasn't addicted to cocaine
Good.
Anymore.
Stephen, can we go to a quick break and then come back? Are you okay to hold on for a minute?
Yes, sir.
Fantastic. Thank you so much indeed. Stephen Tobolowsky we're talking to. Go and download his podcast, The Tobolowsky Files. And I've got so many questions. I want you to join in as well, Kath.
Oh, yeah.
So I know you've got a lot of questions as
I
well. We're going to get the iceberg. The tip of the iceberg is all we're going to get. But what a thrill. Thank you, Stephen. This is The Late Night Alternative with Ian Lee and Catherine Boyle on Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Listen. Phone. Talk.
Talk Radio.
We'll get you talking.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Excuse me.
Oh, Dad.
Hello, I'm Martin Kellner.
And I'm his daughter, Ruthie.
We do a podcast. It's called Ruthie, Me and My Dad.
In which I tell him how he's wrong about most things.
And I explain to her who the Bee Gees were. It's on Acast and Apple Podcasts.
And all your favourite podcast providers.
It's a unique generation gap conversation between a baby boomer dad
and his Generation Z daughter.
That's Ruthie, Me and My Dad. Brand new episodes every Thursday.
Uncut, after-hours conversation for the up-all-night generation.
The Late Night Alternative with Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
We'll get you talking.
But this is a thrill. There are podcasts, there are books that have been written. Stephen's written books as well, and of course there is a movie. Stephen, before we go on to the next proper question, I need to ask, Tobolowsky, Tobolowsky, which is the correct one? Because I've said both, and I was going to stick with one, and I didn't, and I'm sorry.
I think they're both good. I went and asked my Uncle Nathan, who was the historian of our family, the same question. I said, because they all pronounce it differently. I said, is it Tobolowsky, Tobolowsky, Tobolowsky? And he said, you can pronounce it any way you not want because it's not really your name.
Oh, blimey.
And I went, what? He says, yeah, when grandfather came to America, he came through Galveston, Texas, not Ellis Island. And he didn't speak the English very well, and the guard who was bringing him into the country didn't speak the Yiddish kite or whatever grandfather was speaking. And so he asked, who are you? And grandfather only know the who, wo, from German, meaning where, not who, but where
yeah.
are you? Thinking he was saying, where are you from? And so in his grandfather's way, he said, I'm Abraham. From Tobolowsk. And so the guy didn't understand him.
Right.
And so he said, okay, from now on, you're Abraham Tobolowsky. So according to that legend,
incredible.
I got my name the same way Don Corleone got his name in The Godfather.
Incredible. Catherine, you wanted to ask Stephen something. There's so much we want to ask, but go on.
First of all, I wanted to say thank you for telling us about your mother. No, the podcast, the bits about your mum were great. The David Byrne going to your family home and being offered an array of drinks several times had me in tux. It was so funny.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, my mother is... magnificent. If you're listening to the podcast, one of the first podcasts I wanted to do about my mother was, I think, the fourth one, number four, called The Alchemist. And here in America, National Public Radio named that podcast as one of the top recorded podcasts done. So that's a good one to introduce you to my mother.
Brilliant.
Because it's pretty hilarious and pretty... heartbreaking. It's pretty great.
Yeah, actually, it's just wonderful. Thank you. You paint such beautiful pictures. I also wanted to ask you, I know you've worked with many greats, and I know Ian wants to ask you about Steven Seagal at some point.
Yes, I do. But
but I wanted to ask you about Gerard Depardieu, because I was a languages student in the mid-90s, and Gerard Depardieu seemed to do the impossible, which was kind of crossover. As a man who wasn't a matinee idol and didn't have great English, he crossed over and he became quite famous in America. And I know you worked on a film with him.
Yes, My Father the Hero, we did that in the Bahamas, and I did that with my wife, Anne. She played my wife in the movie.
Oh,
and
wow.
I think it was one of Katherine Heigl's first roles. I think Kathy Heigl was maybe early teens, 11, 12, 13, around in there. She plays the female lead in that. And Gerard, I was a huge fan of his. Mm. And we were shooting at the Ocean Club, I know, in the Bahamas. And I had specifically learned this piece of Mozart that was used as the soundtrack of one of his films. And so in between takes, I went over to the grand piano that was there at the party, and I started playing this Mozart piece. And Gerard came over and said, "That sounds so familiar." And I said, "Gerard, it's a song from your last movie that came out." He goes, oh, that's wonderful. We got to be about 3 a.m. and I started playing the Moonlight Sonata. Whenever you see anything in a movie that takes place at night, you got to figure the actors were up all night.
Yeah.
So it's about 3 a.m. We're on the beach in the Bahamas, moon and stars, and I start playing the Moonlight Sonata just in the background in between shots. And one of the Bahamian men who was an extra in the movie, working as a waiter, came up to me and said, "That is the most beautiful song I've ever heard. Is there a recording of it?"
Well,
and I said, "Oh, yeah. There are lots of recordings of it." He says, "Well, I'm getting married next month, and I would like this song to be played in my wedding."
Wow.
"Because it's the only song I've ever heard that's as beautiful as my wife."
Oh, well played.
Ladies
what
and gentlemen,
shot.
We have a winner.
There we go.
Help me, please. Gerard on this movie, Gerard Depardieu, I always thought he was the greatest actor in the world. We had so much fun shooting the movie, and it was such a treat for me to be so close to, really, at that time in my life, I thought he was the greatest actor in film. So to work with him was such a treasure, and it was one of the great moments for me.
Stephen, why acting? How did you get into acting? Because you say you grew up in Texas. I kind of imagine that, you know, we think of Texas, we think of, you know, big men with big hats and oil and, or, you know, kind of manly pursuits. Not saying acting isn't manly, but the arts and creativity and performing doesn't kind of strike me as a normal Texan endeavor. So how did you get into acting?
Oh, this is really a stupid answer. This is going to challenge everyone. I got into acting because when I was 5 years old, I thought monsters were real. And I loved monsters. I loved Godzilla, and I loved Dracula and the Wolfman. And I thought if I became an actor, I could hang out with these monsters.
Oh, fantastic.
And that propelled me through my early years doing plays around, you know, I'm getting ready to work with Godzilla, hopefully someday. And then I got to college, and well, in I don't want to jump anything because it's all pretty grim. And I got sick when I was 13 years old, and I couldn't play anymore. I couldn't do sports. I couldn't go outside. So I spent a lot of time indoors and for about 2 years, and I began reading plays.
Yeah.
And I began thinking, well, I could act. That's indoors. And I became one of the big actors at our high school. And then I went to college, and I thought acting was noble. It was the first time that I encountered Shakespeare and Chekhov and Shaw and all those great, great writers. And then I came out to Los Angeles, and I'm auditioning for Butt Crack Plumber. I'm auditioning for, you know, Homeless Man Number Two. And I realized it has nothing to do with nobility.
No.
But at that point, it was the only thing I knew how to do.
Yeah. And, I mean, can you believe it? We were looking at your IMDb, and, you know, there are some years when you've got like 10 movies coming out. You've been constantly working. You've been in over 200 movies, you know, some small movies, some huge movies. The Philadelphia Experiment, by the way, one of my favourite films. You're still working with things like the Goldbergs and stuff like that. Can you believe it? Can you believe that this incredible career and life that you've had and you are still having and you are still successful in?
Yeah, it's shocking. Right now, we just finished the third year of One Day at a Time on Netflix, and I don't know if it plays in England. If it does, you got to watch it. It's the most spectacular show. But it's like, here it is. I'm almost 68, I think.
Wow.
And I have been working on the best projects all together in one chunk I've ever worked on in my life. One Day at a Time is absolutely brilliant show.
It is. I've just checked it. It's on the UK Netflix, One Day at a Time. So I'm having some of that this weekend.
Well, you got to watch it. You got to watch it. It's absolutely hilarious and heartbreaking, if you could believe both of those things in the same sentence. And it's like an old traditional sitcom. Our executive producer, Norman Lear, like the original One Day at a Time. Mm. But this really pushes it to the limit. What I tell everybody, we just premiered the third season. What I tell everybody, watch the first show of the first season, and if you don't flip, if you don't go like, wow, I love these people and I love these stories, I mean, maybe it's not for you, but I got to tell you, it is. We just got the rare 100% Rotten Tomato rating.
No.
Like, saying like,
that's
yeah,
incredible.
100%.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you. TV Guide has come out over here and said it's one of the best shows ever produced. And it is. I mean, it's got it. And this is happening now in my life.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Goldbergs. Goldbergs is an institution here in America. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's a great show. I just finished doing 2 years on Silicon Valley, which I think they're showing in the UK.
It's
now.
A great series, Silicon Valley. Yeah, I love it.
Hilarious. All these things are happening to me now later in life, and I so appreciate it that I was able to do kind of iconic things in the past, like Groundhog Day and other things, and now I'm able to work with such great people, like on One Day at a Time and great scripts. I mean, really, it's amazing. I pinch myself all the time.
You know that there's a TV channel over here that every Groundhog Day, they show the movie Groundhog Day all day. All day. It's one of the Sky Channels. You know that, Carol?
Yes, I do.
It's one of the Sky Channels. They show it all 24 hours, Groundhog Day on a loop. Yes. Imagine.
And I have to remind the listeners here, when Groundhog Day came out, it was not that well reviewed. It got like 3 out of 4 stars.
Oh, did it?
3.5 out of 5 stars. It was like considered very good for a kind of a typical Bill Murray movie.
Yeah.
And after the film had been out for like a month at the theaters, I get a call from our producer, Trevor Albert, and he said, Stephen, we may have a hit. And I go, really? He says, well, every week the box office keeps going up.
Wow.
And it can't be the reviews, so it has to be word of mouth. And Ian, you want to talk about serendipity.
Yeah.
I think one of the miracles that's made Groundhog Day a classic and an evergreen is that we shot it in Woodstock, Illinois, and it was bitter cold when we shot it. And so everyone in the movie is wearing winter scarves and coats and hats. And so there is no fashion to go out of.
There you
know,
go.
Winter clothing stays kind of the same.
Yeah.
But you don't have the shoulder pads.
Isn't
you don't
funny.
Have the weird hairdos. Everybody's all bundled up. And it looks universal.
I feel like I'm treating you like I've got a rock singer on and I'm just putting a quarter in and just getting you to do your greatest hits every time. But. The story that I heard, and I phoned Kath up and said, Kath, you've got to listen to this episode. It's nuts. And then she phoned me back when she heard it, was when I think you were doing like what we call rep over here, like summer stock theatre. And is the guy called Vince, the ex-Marine cook? That you have?
Vinny, the cook.
Vinny.
Yeah.
Can we hear that? I mean, that is an incredible story.
Oh, well, we had, no one could be a cook at this. You have to understand this theater. It wasn't a dinner theater. It was like, we did the classics. We did Oscar Wilde. But we had, like, no real audiences. So the manager of the theater managed to hook up our plays with the local prison and also the local insane asylum. So we would do Importance of Being Earnest for prisoners, you know, and they come in rattling their chains. Is swearing legal on your station?
What does it begin with?
GDBS.
I think we can say that once. Yeah, go on.
Okay. So anyway, I'm playing Algernon in The Importance of Being Earnest, and not a laugh, not a single laugh, not a sound from the prisoners. You have to understand, this is one of the greatest plays ever crafted. It is one of the funniest plays, not a laugh. The curtain is coming down at the end of Act One, and all I hear is a lone voice coming from the audience. How much longer we have to listen to all this goddamn bullshit?
And you have to go back out again.
We have two more acts to do. We have two more acts to do. It was amazing. We did Midsummer Night's Dream for the insane asylum. And one of the young men in the front row, like when the fairies came out of the forest, I'm playing bottom, pulled his pants down and horrified all of us actors on the stage as he did what he was going to do on the front row. And we're freaking out backstage, and the head of this theater said, gang, just imagine you're performing for Shakespeare's audience. Shakespeare's audience. This is so anyway, you couldn't keep a cook at this place.
No.
We ended up getting this ex-Marine named Vinny.
Yes.
Vinny as the cook. And during Midsummer Night's Dream, Vinny was crazy. We're all in there. We all have different jobs to do at the end of cooking. And I see people kind of vanishing during dinner. And the head of the theater comes in to yell at us again. This is the guy who talked about Shakespeare's audience. He goes, Vinny did not poison the onions. If anyone says Vinny has poisoned the onions, you could get your hat and coat and get the hell off the plate. And I'm thinking like, what do you mean poison the onions? What are we talking about? Now, I'm looking at my plate. I just had like a whole beef stroganoff with a bunch of creamed onions. And I'm thinking like, huh, you know? So it was my job to help wash the dishes.
Yeah.
So I go back into the kitchen and there's the big pot of onions and there's a box of rat poison on the shelf open by the onions. I'm thinking like, so I go talk to our technical director. I said, Tony, you know, I think maybe Vinny did poison the onions. And So we're all getting ready. The audience, if you call it that, starts showing up at the theater, and people start vanishing, and I start hearing people throw up all over the place. All the actors, this you have to imagine this sylvan scene, this theater existing in the beautiful mountains of upstate New York, now filled with actors running out into the bushes vomiting. So Al Maisel comes back saying, well, in the old tradition of the theater, the show must go on. He put vomit buckets on each side of the stage. And so he says, just keep doing the play. And if you have to throw up, just work your way over to the vomit bucket, throw up, and keep going with the play. So I start getting terrible stomach cramps as Bottom, which is a fairly sizable role, right before the play starts, and I begin puking. I'm sure your audience is at this point. So I am doing Bottom's Dream, and I'm looking out at the audience. They're still there. They're watching us like nothing, like this is no strange thing. Like we have this actor on stage who's wandering over to one side of the stage, vomiting. Continues with his speech, wanders over to the other side, and vomits, fucking keeps going, and they're still sitting there like it's normal. Now, some of the actors did not make it to the buckets, they just vomited on the back curtain, and the audience stays. They stay for the entire show. They applaud at the end. It was amazing.
They applaud. I would hope so.
Wow.
Oh my God.
Vinny vanished in the night, and we have no idea what happened to Vinny as he tried to murder all of us.
Now, that brings us actually very smoothly to the man who refused to murder you.
Oh, no, listen, okay, listen, we'll have, if you don't mind giving us one more story, Stephen, because I can listen to you all night, but let's have one more, because okay. I read this and then I saw a video of you talking about this. This is incredible. Steven Seagal, who, let's be honest, now in 2019, very thick, dark, lustrous hair.
It's amazing.
I don't know what he's doing, but he's really looked after his hair. Very good genes. You were in a movie with him. You had to kind of wait for him to wake up before you could audition or something, didn't you?
Right. I had to audition for him at his house at 10 a.m. And his house, like I live, if you know Los Angeles, I live in the San Fernando Valley. He lived over in Beverly Hills. So it was quite a drive for me. But I got over there in the morning, 10 a.m., knocked on his door. His housekeeper let me in. No Stephen to audition for.
No.
And I was told that he is still asleep. He slept till 12:30.
Oh, no.
So I waited in his living room. I waited in his living room for 2.5 hours before he comes down in his pajamas and said, so, you know, in this movie, you are a serial killer, but I really want to feel the emotion from you. I really want you to cry. Are you able to cry? I said, well, I feel like crying right now. I could cry for you right now. So anyway, I have to shoot my scene with Steven Seagal the first day of shooting.
Yeah.
And the number of times, now this is weird, Ian, the number of times in my career I have shot the first scene of a movie. Groundhog Day, Bill Murray and I began shooting that street scene the first crack of dawn of the first day.
Isn't that fun?
Same thing with Glimmer Man. So John Gray, our director, came up to me in a hurry before we start shooting. And he said, got problems, Steven. Steven Seagal says he doesn't want to kill you in the scene anymore. He doesn't want to be violent. I go, he doesn't want to be violent. He goes, yeah, the people at Warner Brothers were telling him, Steven, baby, boobala, you dance with who brung you. I mean, that's all you do.
You dance with who brung you.
You know, they don't hire you because you're a great actor. You kill people. That's what you do. It's like hiring Bruce Lee and telling him, don't do any kung fu. That's what you do. So they have Steven Seagal, and he comes in and he says, you know, I've been thinking. I think it's bad karma to be killing people in this movie. And John Gray is standing behind Stephen, gesturing to me like, shut up, Stephen, to me. Don't talk. Don't say anything. And I said, well, Stephen, this is the way I see it. I see that actually you are helping my reincarnational development as a human being. I'm a serial killer in this movie. I'm in agony. My soul is in agony. But if you kill me like you're supposed to, you're actually benefiting me and mankind. And he goes, I like that. So we do the scene. I capture a priest. Steven Seagal kills me. He kills me real good. In fact, in the movie, they had set up this contraption to where he shoots me several times and my chest explodes.
Yeah.
And I fall out of frame. And Steven comes up with a smoking gun and looks down at me. And we cut out of that scene. So I think we're done. And then about 2.5 months later, I get a panic phone call from John Gray, the director. And he said, Steven, we have a problem. Steven Seagal has been ad-libbing in the rest of the movie saying, thank God I didn't kill that guy in the church. Is there any way you could come in and add some lines to the scene to indicate that you're not dead? I go, well, sure. So I go over to see ADR, which is film talk, but that's when you add voice to a film that's already been shot. You take out swear words if you're doing Deadwood or what, you do all sorts of things. So I'm looking at this shot. I'm there with Keenan Ivory Wayans. He's watching too. And Steven shoots me. My chest explodes. I fall out of frame, blood flying everywhere. And John Gray says, now is when we want you to say something. And I go, now? And Keenan Ivory Wayans just kind of looks at me, shakes his head. He goes, man, now we are in the area of high comedy. And he walks out. And I'm thinking like, I go, well, John, there's not much I could say. I mean, my chest has exploded. There's blood everywhere. You know, so he says, well, just try some things. So I fall out of frame after this brutal shooting. I go like, oh, you know, you just nicked me. Or,
it's just a flesh wound.
I think I ended up saying, finish me, you bastard. Like that. What? They ended up cutting out the shot of my chest exploding, and then they had some shot of some guy wearing my costume just being shot very neatly, falling out of frame. They just kind of re-edited it. And, so that was my experience with Steven Seagal. He was... You know, he's the man that only Putin loves.
He's, Stephen, you know. Listen, brother, thank you so much. You have an open invitation. You come on whenever you want. You have to come over here and do like a one man show as well. Come to the UK. We'll sort it out. We'll get a theatre. We'll get you an audience. Come and do a one man show here, Stephen.
Hey, it's a deal. It's a deal. I got friends over there, too. I'd love to come over and see them and say hello. That's a deal.
Let's make it happen.
I'll give you guys a call from time to time.
Oh, listen, you've got my email. You are welcome whenever you want. Listen, One Day at a Time is the show. The season three is, I've checked it. It's all on Netflix in the UK. The Tobolowsky Files is the podcast. Very quickly, are you doing any more of those, or is that finished now, Stephen?
No. I was just telling David Ferrier from New Zealand, I've just finished 7 more.
Oh, great.
David Chin, who's my producer, he's working for Jeff Bezos now. He's really busy. So what I do is I write and record the podcast, and then I give it to David, and then we finish them up together. So I'm going to try to get 10 together and release those 10.
Stephen, it's such a thrill. We've been so excited you coming on, and you did not disappoint, sir. You are such a great storyteller.
Oh, you made me laugh so much.
You really made us laugh. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Well, thank you, guys, and much love to all you folks on that side of the pond.
Lovely. Stephen Tobolowsky, do you want to go and say goodbye to him properly? I mean, fantastic. I cannot recommend, excuse me, the Tobolowsky Files enough. Such a great podcast. My voice is going...
I've been laughing too much and it's done my throat and we're late for the news. Who cares? This is the Late Night Alternative with Ian and Kath on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Talk Radio. We'll get you talking.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.